Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Monday, the 2nd of October, these are our main stories. The fallout continues from Saturday's temporary deal to avoid a US government shutdown, as further military aid to Ukraine is now under threat and deep political divisions are exposed. Hundreds of thousands of Poles join an opposition rally in Warsaw ahead of a crucial general election. And we hear from the writer of a new play which recalls the miraculous escape of Danish Jews during World War II.
Ordinary Danes, fishermen, policemen, nurses, priests. They stood up and they helped them at risk of their own lives and potentially their families' lives as well.
Also in this podcast, Turkey hits Kurdish targets in northern Iraq following a suicide bombing near the parliament in Ankara. And
very proud. I mean, it was a roller coaster today. Never felt so many emotions. Our guys just hung in there like I knew they would.
High drama as European golfers hold off an American revival to reclaim the Ryder Cup. Mutiny could be about to descend on US Congress. A hardline Republican, Matt Gaetz, says he will seek to oust House Speaker Kevin McCarthy after he defied the right wing in his own party and pushed through a last-minute spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. Without enough support from the Republicans, he relied on opposition Democrats. On the US broadcaster ABC on Sunday, Mr. Gaetz accused Mr. McCarthy of having lied to conservative members of the party.
America's lawmakers take one up or down vote on the funding of the entire government. That is crazy. That is the reason we're $33 trillion in debt. We want to move to single subject spending bills. So he made that commitment. He broke it. And if at this time, next week, Kevin McCarthy is still Speaker of the House, it will because the Democrats bailed him out and he can be their speaker, not mine.
McCarthy said he would survive Gaetz's challenge, which he dismissed as a personal quibble.
Matt voted against the most conservative ability to secure our border. He's more interested in securing TV interviews than doing something. He wanted to push us into a shutdown, even threatening his own district with all the military people there who would not be paid. If he's upset because he tried to push us in a shutdown and I made sure government didn't shut down, then let's have that fight.
Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley told me what this row says about divisions within the Republican Party.
It tells us it's exactly as divided, no more, no less than it was last week, last month. Indeed, when Kevin McCarthy was elected as Speaker, he's not a liked man. Let's be frank about it. Democrats despise him because he had launched an impeachment inquiry into the President Joe Biden, breaking a promise that he'd hold a vote on the floor before he did that. Republicans are not his biggest fans either. If you look back to his election, it took 4 days and 15 rounds to put him in office. And ever since he's done that, at least 9 very hardline Republicans, Matt Gaetz chief among them, have been threatening to remove him from office. He says now he's going to do that, but actually he's probably not going to manage it on this occasion.
What would have to happen for McCarthy to go?
Due to a compromise deal that McCarthy did when he was elected as Speaker, any member of the House, Republican or Democrats, can put a motion on the floor to vacate, and then you'd need a simple majority of the House. You'd have to find 218 members of the House of Representatives to support that. Now, the reason that's not going to happen is Democratic politicians supported the very last-minute deal that Kevin McCarthy put to the House yesterday. They compromised massively because it did not allow any additional funding for Ukraine. Republicans compromised because it didn't cut as deeply as they wanted to. But the Democrats only supported it because McCarthy promised them that if they did to keep the government open, that he would, within the coming days, introduce a separate funding bill for Ukraine, a temporary funding bill. Now, look, here's the reality. No Kevin McCarthy almost certainly means no Ukraine funding bill, which almost certainly means Democratic politicians, through very gritted teeth, will support a man they really have very little time for.
Sean Dilley. Now to Slovakia, where in yesterday's podcast, We were reporting that the liberal pro-Western party, Progressive Slovakia, were unexpectedly heading for victory in Saturday's election. Now, a day later, the reverse has happened, because the pro-Moscow leader of the Smer party, Robert Fico, has emerged as the winner. He's raised many eyebrows in the West by vowing to stop sending military aid to Ukraine. From Prague in the neighbouring Czech Republic, Rob Cameron reports on a remarkable turn of events.
Jubilation at Smer party headquarters as they realise they were on track for a fourth chance at government. Yet again, Robert Fico has wrong-footed his opponents. Who wouldn't be singing from a balcony at 4 a.m. after a comeback like this? Later, there were glimpses of what a new Fico government might look like, and perhaps just a hint that the thundering rhetoric on Ukraine might soon be retired.
Slovakia and people in Slovakia have bigger problems than Ukraine. That's all I can say. If Smer forms the next government, then we'll do everything in our power, including at EU level, to ensure peace talks start as soon as possible.
Indeed, Slovak observers are more alarmed about what Smer plans at home than abroad. Mr. Fico said he'd immediately fire the chief of police and the special prosecutor.
Rob Cameron. Hundreds of thousands of opposition supporters have been rallying in Warsaw ahead of parliamentary elections later this month. Footage on social media showed wide avenues and huge squares packed, with Polish and European Union flags prominent. The opposition leader, Donald Tusk, called the march a breakthrough in Poland's history, but his party is still trailing in the opinion polls. It's trying to stop the right-wing incumbent, the Law and Justice Party, from winning an unprecedented third term, saying the government is endangering the democratic gains of the past three decades. These people explained why they joined the protest.
Poland to be free. I don't want the return of the communist regime, which I remember very well. Drab street, people afraid of talking politics or anything, in fact. The oppressive police.
I feel like a European, but I'm no longer so sure that we will stay in the European Union if Law and Justice stays for the third term.
So, did it live up to its billing of the March of a Million Hearts? A question for our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, who was there.
It was certainly huge. There were hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Warsaw. The city hall has said it was a million people. The governing party and state media are playing it down massively, talking about less than 100,000. But I stood there for 3 hours and I saw huge crowds of people pouring past me nonstop. It was a really big turnout. And everyone who we spoke to who'd come out, many of them were carrying the Polish flag, lots of them carrying the EU flag as well. They all see this as a really critical election for Poland and for its future. Lots of people believe, as the opposition leader Donald Tusk has been saying, that this is about whether or not it remains a democratic country going forward and about its place in the EU, because they are portraying the governing party, Law and Justice, as a threat to democracy, as eroding basic principles like the rule of law and the freedom of the media. And they say all of that is jeopardising Poland's democratic future.
And the government have accused the opposition of being unpatriotic. Just give us a flavour of their time in power.
That claim of unpatriotic is precisely why there were so many Polish flags there today, and precisely why Donald Tusk made a point of saying that he loved Poland and he was ready to die for Poland, because it's been quite a vicious election campaign so far. We've seen some really nasty language used actually by both sides. I mean, Donald Tusk describes the government as evil. The government describes him as a foreign agent and as a stooge of Germany, essentially as a traitor. And there have been all sorts of social media adverts and videos and general language from the government portraying the opposition as betraying Poland's national interests. So I think that's a lot of what today's sea of red and white was about. They described wanting an open and tolerant Poland. They want an end to the friction with the EU that they see has been increasing under the governing party so far. and they want a country where they feel it has the kind of future that they would like to choose for their children. One of the biggest messages from today was Donald Tusk telling people to go out and to get all of their friends and their colleagues to vote, though he was very much making the case that this is the most important election in Poland since 1989 and the end of communism. He said there was a huge amount at stake and that everybody should turn out and take part in the vote.
Sarah Rainsford in Warsaw. FIFA and its African subsidiary, the Confederation of African Football, are facing accusations of failing to take effective action to deal with the scandal of abuse of young footballers in Gabon. BBC Africa Eye has spoken to dozens of witnesses who describe a long-standing sexual abuse ring within Gabon's football world. Kadidia Tu Sise reports.
We were at a football training camp for the under-17 selection team.
This young man is talking about his time as a footballer in Gabon's youth team, where using an actor's voice to protect his identity.
On the fourth night of the camp, they came to wake me and my best friend. They took us to a room with red lights. It was full of naked men. They started touching me and my friend, and I just didn't understand. I wanted to scream.
He says he was sexually assaulted and made to watch his friend get raped by their football coaches. Among them was Patrick Asumueyi, better known as Capello, the head coach of Gabon's youth team. Africa Eye has spoken to more than 30 witnesses who said Capello and others were predators in a sexual abuse ring that has plagued Gabon's football world for decades. The BBC was told the Gabonese Football Federation, FEGAFOOT, were made aware of it. Former Gabon international player Parfait Ndong says he escalated the issue all the way to the top.
I spoke to the president of the league, I spoke to the president of the federation.
But it was only after an expose in The Guardian in 2021 that Capello was arrested. He admitted to charges of raping, grooming and exploiting young players. Months later, the president of FEGAFOOT, Pierre-Alain Mugengi, was also arrested on the charge of failing to report crimes of paedophilia. But unlike Capello, football governing bodies did not suspend him from his role. Rémi Ebanega is the president of Gabon's National Footballers' Union.
The local justice system has imprisoned the president of the federation, and FIFA did nothing. He continued to manage the federation while he was in prison.
After almost 6 months in prison, Mugengi was provisionally released, and in July 2023, he was re-elected to the Executive Committee of CAF, the Confederation of African Football, a FIFA subsidiary. CAF Secretary General has defended the decision to not impose sanctions on Mugengi.
If today there is no decision of the justice saying that Mugengi, you are guilty, you are guilty, you are sanctioned, how CAF can sanction this?
But witnesses say no meaningful child protection measures have been put in place, and both CAF and FIFA have come under criticism for failing to act. Loic Alves is a senior legal counsel for FIFPRO, the International Football Players Union.
CAF and or FIFA, they have no obligation to wait for a state decision before they sanction someone for violations of disciplinary codes and codes of ethics.
The BBC believes all suspensions of those arrested have now lapsed. Pierre-Alain Mugengi, FEGAFOOT, FIFA and CAF deny all the allegations made against them. They say all appropriate action was taken as soon as the allegations were made public and FIFA's ethics committee investigation is still ongoing. All parties condemn child abuse in the strongest possible terms. But in Gabon, many are still waiting for both answers and action.
Kadidia Tu Sise. It's been called a miracle that in barely one night during the Second World War, Denmark was able to save 90% of its Jewish population from deportation at the hand of the occupying Nazis. 80 years ago, 7,000 Jews escaped by boat to Sweden following a mysterious tip-off. Bent Melchior, later to become Denmark's chief rabbi, was 14 years old when he boarded one of the fishing boats.
We were gathered in this boat that was supposed to carry herrings But instead of that, they now were carrying human beings. Can you imagine that people started to be sick there in the boat, and we were hiding underneath so that nobody should see that there were so many people on board. So every minute was like an hour.
Shortly before the planned deportation, a warning was given by a chief rabbi. There will be no prayers today. Pack your bags and find a way to disappear. It was this moment that inspired the author Alexander Bolden Safier to pen a play. It will receive its first ever reading in Denmark this week. Safier described the unique warning his own grandfather received to the BBC's Johnny Diamond.
He was working as a tailor in his brother-in-law's shop, and in walked a high-ranking German official. He told my grandfather, my brother-in-law, that they needed to get out and get out as quickly as they could. And it wasn't until many years later that an additional wrinkle to that story really spurred me on.
The wrinkle that you talk about is that it perhaps wasn't just the odd German officer, you know, saying something untoward or leaking something to a friendly Danish native, but in fact that this was leaked on purpose by one of the most senior Nazis in the country.
Well, yes. The narrative immediately after the war was that the right-hand man of Werner Best, who was the plenipotentiary of Denmark, leaked the information. What has since come out is that the German patrol boats that were guarding the waterway between Denmark and Sweden, when it became clear that the Jews were escaping across the water, those patrol boats were all brought into harbour. And the reason, the official reason, was that they all needed a paint job.
All at the same time.
All at the same time. Exactly, exactly. What we now know is that when Hitler ordered Werner Best to make Denmark Judenrein, to make it Jew-free, after the failure of the roundup, Hitler then telegrammed Best to explain himself. And Best said, "I have done what you ordered. I have made Denmark Judenrein, Jew-free." And that comes back to the story of my grandfather, because my grandfather never told us the name of the high-ranking German official that warned him. But his brother-in-law, Nat, on his deathbed mentioned a name, and that name was Werner Best, Dr. Karl Rudolf Werner Best. And so he really had a dilemma on his hands. How is he going to placate Hitler and fulfill that order of making Denmark Judenrein without stopping the flow of agriculture and small arms munitions that were being manufactured in Denmark? And so as a calculating man, I think he made a decision and he played both sides.
You have injected several shades of grey into a history perhaps that the Danes would prefer to see a little more black and white, with clearer heroes and villains involved. But it's a different kind of story that you're telling, more nuanced.
It is, but I don't think that necessarily takes away from the miracle. But I think the miracle is slightly different. It is the fact that ordinary Danes, fishermen, policemen, nurses, priests, they stood up and they helped them at risk of their own lives and potentially their families' lives as well. And yes, it is more nuanced and more complex, but I think that's the difference between a story and reality. And I don't see it as any less of a miracle, but it is certainly less black and white.
Alexander Bolden Safier. And his play about the exodus of Jews from Denmark opens next week in Copenhagen. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
I've been composing mostly pop songs, and after the military, I don't want to do more pop songs. I want to make more serious, deep music.
We meet the creator of the music for the huge Netflix series Squid Game and the Oscar-winning film Parasite. Turkey says it's carried out airstrikes against the PKK rebel group in retaliation for a suicide bombing near the Turkish parliament on Sunday. The blast in Ankara injured two police officers. Victoria Craig is a reporter in the Turkish capital. She told us more about Turkey's protracted fight against the PKK.
The PKK, which is a Kurdish militant group called the Kurdistan Workers' Party, has long been a designated terror organization by the US, Turkey, and the European Union. The Interior Ministry, for its part, according to state media, says that one of the attackers is a member of the group. And this group has as I said, claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it was designed to coincide with the opening of the Turkish parliament this afternoon and carried out by a team linked to one of its own called the Immortals Battalion. And just to put this in a bit of context, this group has carried out attacks across Turkey over the last several decades. Ultimately, it wants an independent state. Now, hours after the group claimed responsibility this evening here in Turkey for the bombing today, the Defense Department said that it has already carried out strikes in northern Iraq, where the PKK is based. And it said that many terrorists were neutralized across 20 sites. It destroyed caves, bunkers, shelters, and warehouses, quote, in order to eliminate terrorist attacks against our people and security forces.
Victoria Craig in Ankara. 3 days of mourning have been declared in the Spanish region of Murcia after a fire which engulfed three nightclubs killed at least 13 people. The fire is said to have started in one of the clubs in the early morning and quickly spread. Several people are being treated in hospital. Jose Ballesta is the mayor of the city of Murcia.
What we are now concentrating on is looking after the families of the victims, recover the bodies, the search for those who could still be in there. And those are the urgent, the important issues.
Our correspondent in Spain, Guy Hedgeco, told me the latest on the rescue operation.
The emergency services are still in these nightclubs. There's a tremendous amount of rubble because of the fire. They're looking to see if there are more bodies. There certainly are other people who are believed to be missing. And then the big task right now for the police is to identify the bodies that have been found. So they're doing DNA tests on those bodies with the cooperation of relatives of people who are believed to have been in the nightclubs during the fire. And so we've been warned that the process of identifying the bodies could take quite a while and quite some days, possibly.
Do the police have any idea at this stage what started the fire?
No. I mean, we've been told that there's no theory at the moment regarding the cause of the fire. What we do know is that it appears to have started in one of these nightclubs, which are on the outskirts of Murcia city, and there are two nightclubs next to it, and the fire spread across these three nightclubs very quickly. One of them was particularly badly affected. Certainly part of its structure seemed to collapse because of the fire, and that in turn has made the rescue operation that much more difficult.
And how rare are such incidents in Spain?
Well, this is the worst nightclub fire in Spain, certainly since 1990. There was a fire in Zaragoza when 43 people died. And, you know, we haven't seen anything on this scale in the three decades since. So this kind of tragedy is unusual. And when you add to that the fact that Murcia is not a huge city, it obviously has a tremendous impact on the local community.
Guy Hedgeco. The United Nations has put boots on the ground in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, and it's for the first time in roughly 30 years. Since Azerbaijan took control during a short military offensive last month, over 100,000 ethnic Armenians have packed up their lives and fled. Among them is Spartak Harutyunyan.
I left so many things there, but I'm not concerned about it. If there's a choice between leaving things behind and staying, I chose leaving.
Azerbaijan has been accused of ethnic cleansing by the Armenians. I asked our Europe editor Danny Eberhard how the Azeri government has responded to the allegations.
Well, they deny them outright, Nigel. They say that the ethnic Armenian population of Nagorno-Karabakh are free to stay or go. There is certainly no compulsion on their part, they say, in terms of forcing people out, as has been alleged. One of the presidential advisers says that there's been no case of violence against civilians. The Karabakh Armenians may dispute that, but that's his position. There is, of course, a huge lack of trust between the two sides due to repeated outbreaks of fighting over the past three decades. And France has criticised Azerbaijan. They basically accused Azerbaijan of waiting until virtually all of the Karabakh Armenians have left before inviting in the UN.
And what is the latest on the exodus of refugees?
The exodus has slowed to a trickle. I mean, it unfurled with staggering speed since the 20th of September when the Azeri military operation ended. But on Saturday, the Armenian authorities talked about 100,417 people having left. Today's figure earlier on Sunday was 100,490, so just a difference of 73 people. One journalist for the French news agency AFP said that basically he'd been on the border and seen one car. What we don't know still at this stage is exactly how many Karabakh Armenians remain in the enclave. There are also some people reportedly with special needs. And there is a bit of a disparity between the 120,000 people that was estimated to be the population before the latest outbreak of fighting and the 100,000 people who have left. That hasn't been accounted for fully. But we do know the needs of the people who have fled are huge. The WHO, the World Health Organization, has talked about the fact it's going to take a long time to resolve this crisis. They're sending in experts, mental health issues, burns treatment for the people who survived the fuel depot explosion on Monday, and things like prefabricated clinics to try to cope with this huge humanitarian crisis within Armenia now.
Danny Eberhardt. Golf's Ryder Cup is back in European hands after they held off an American fight back on the final day of competition in Rome. Europe began with a 5-point lead, which they ultimately maintained to win by 16.5 points to 11.5. But there were plenty of nerves for the home crowd as the US team started the day well before eventually falling away. Europe's captain Luke Donald was delighted.
Very proud. I mean, it was a roller coaster today. Never felt so many emotions. But our guys just hung in there like I knew they would. And just glad we got over the line. Just so happy for these 12 guys that they can remember this week forever.
Our sports reporter James Gregg watched the day's dramatic developments.
All eyes were on those top matches. European captain Luke Donald had loaded the 12 singles matches up with his star names. John Rahm, Victor Hovland, Justin Rose, the elder statesman of either side, and Rory McIlroy made up the top four matches. And it was very nip and tuck. John Rahm and the world number one Scottie Scheffler had a fantastic ding-dong battle. That ended up as a tied result. But there was so much, as we say, red on the leaderboard. Red for Team USA. In the end, as we know now, it got over the line. But at so many points, there was so many different ebbs and flows. We had no idea which way it was going. And you could feel that all the way across the golf course. It was a fizzing atmosphere.
And of course, there was drama in the clubhouse on Saturday evening between Rory McIlroy and one of the American caddies.
McIlroy wasn't happy with an incident that happened in the very last of the four-ball matches on Saturday afternoon. That obviously boiled over. There were words exchanged between the caddy of Patrick Cantlay, who himself was involved in a bit of controversy. That was something that all of us, as commentators and journalists, were talking about. The fans were well aware of it as well. You could sense that they knew about the needle that had been created, and that obviously bubbled through into this morning. And it did create a very exciting contest. That was kind of what this morning needed, because the gap was so big, the lead was so huge in favour of Team Europe. As it got a little bit closer, it really did feel like there was something to play for Team USA. That was very much a really cool talking point.
James Gregg in Rome. A celebration of South Korean pop culture is coming to London this week with the K Music Festival. Now in its 10th year, the festival will host big names like Yung Jae-il, who made the soundtracks for the internationally successful Netflix series Squid Game and Oscar-winning film Parasite. He's been speaking to Krupa Padhi.
Let's start with Squid Game. Immediately identifiable. I remember hearing it through my neighbour's walls because everybody was watching it. I thought, that is the music for Squid Game. How does that process go, making a track for a series like that?
Well, for me, every project is just the same. I start from the script and director's intention. It was just the first time for me to make series because I'm very used to 2 hours of film, and it was 9 hours film, so I had to be prepared a lot.
But then what's remarkable is your ability to switch genres, because you hear the music from Squid Game and then you hear the music from Parasite, which is remarkably different. That classical vibe you have going there. How easy is it to make that transition?
It's not that easy, but I have to do that because director's intention and the script is very important. They are everything. So
If they requires classical, if they requires rock, if they requires hip-hop, I have to do that.
Am I right in thinking that in the case of Parasite, the music score was rejected 7 times?
Oh, that's average.
Really?
<Yeah. laughs>
But equally, the same director has said that you are one of the most detailed and delicate music directors on earth. Quite the praise. You've actually said writing music was my only way to survive.
Oh, how did you find that?
that's yeah. A very moving statement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're so well known now within your country, but even globally as a result of the hits that you've had. To hear someone say that, mm-hmm. in many countries, people start out as musicians and realise they can't make money out of this. But for you, it feels like it's been the opposite. Can you expand on that a bit more, that journey?
Well, I just started a band and then become a musician who get paid. And then every Korean male has to go to military. It's a mandatory mm-hmm. for 2 years. I've been composing for mostly pop songs. And after the military, I don't want to do more pop songs. I want to make more serious, deep music. Mr. Bong just recognized me, Mr. Bong Joon-ho, who is the director of Parasite. He was an executive producer of a film called Sea Fog. That was the first film I composed. And then moved to Okja, a Netflix film. And while I was doing Okja, this is very exciting. And I can express all kinds of genre and all kinds of feelings, very deep feelings. Happiness, despair, sorrow, everything. This is very exciting for a composer. So I just fell in love with film scoring.
South Korean composer, producer, and music director, Jung Jae-il. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.